So let's go give Dan Smail the impossible task now of having sat and watched most of this meeting. Now, to come and tell us what his thoughts are. Dan, I'm going to actually read this because this is your own language. He has an abiding passion to bring time depth back into the ways in which we teach and research history. Dan's a history professor at Harvard, and he has a book called On Deep History in the Brain, in which he's seeking to transcend the legacy of Judeo-Christian sacred chronology. So let's see how that happens. Dan Smail.
Thanks, Roger. And thanks especially. This has been an amazing symposium with lots of stuff to think about. Earlier, Roger mentioned the giant turtle, the sacred turtle of Hindu belief, which of course rests on the back of another turtle. And as Sean Carroll said yesterday, then it's turtles all the way down. Now this is a model for gravity and not a historical model, but Sean and I have both taken it, and many people have taken it, as a way of thinking about deep time. It's the turtles on the backs of turtles is the way that those of us who do deep history think about how we get back to the past. And thinking about these turtles, I was reminded of a conversation that I had with a senior colleague at the university where I first began to teach, who described to me the histories that he had to teach when he first started teaching in the 1960s. And he said to me, Dan, he said, I had to teach everything. I had to teach history all the way back to the very beginning. And he meant Western civilization in Sumeria. Now, the only reason that particular anecdote stuck in my mind, because at that very time, that very same semester, I was teaching a natural history of humankind, which in some serious way I began with Australopithecines, although I had a gesture back to the Big Bang, and I gather I cannot do that anymore, that there isn't any turtle back there. But we had very different turtles. His turtle was a turtle that was resting very solidly on the banks of the Tigris and the Euphrates 6,000 years ago, and my turtle was a much older turtle that was farther down the column. And this is in 2000, and it got me to thinking about the question of, well, when exactly does history begin? And as I began to poke away at this, I, as you might imagine, came across a number of philosophical and epistemological and methodological issues concerning when history begins. But in particular, I ran across curricular issues or disciplinary issues. And then I was reminded early in this conference of the remarks that Dan Dennett and Harry Crota were making about how it's, as I interpret them, it's not merely a question of making statements about what we ought to be doing. It's a question of finding ways to enact them. And curricula are ways to actually enact the things that we want to do. Just to give you a sense of some of the things that I uncovered when I began looking at the curricula, I was teaching in New York State at the time, and I went to the New York State Social Studies High School curriculum and had a look at when that curriculum began, history. And it began in 4000 BC. That's when human history begins. And I was chatting with some high school history teachers, and I asked them, do you know why they chose 4000 BC? I don't know. Is that when the first city? No. The first city is younger than that. How about writing? Nope. That's 800 years after that. And what they didn't know is, as many of you probably know, is that 4000 BC is pretty much the same date that Archbishop Usher had assigned in the 17th century to the invention, to the creation of the world. This was a bit alarming, as you can imagine, because it made me wonder, is it possible that the field of history is in some way, some small way, complicitous with young earth creationism? Now, because I think the curricular solutions are probably easy to imagine, I'm not going to actually go into that. What I did want to do was fill you in a more philosophical way or historical way on some of the background that explains the fix that history has gotten itself into. And because when I am not a deep historian, I'm a medieval European historian, I hope you won't mind if I start this paper by taking you back briefly to the 6th century. For it was in the late 6th century, as the memory of the Germanic invasions was fading into memory, that a Western European historian named Gregory set out to record the history of the Frankish people. Now, Gregory was the bishop of Tours, which was a Gallo-Roman town located on the banks of the Loire River, about a week's journey southwest of Paris, and outside the pale of direct Frankish settlement and influence in the northern parts of Gaul. Gregory was not satisfied with doing just a history of the Franks. He had grander ambitions to write in a more universal vein. And in his history, he tells us about the ships that come from the Indies to dock at the Red Sea port of Clysma. And he describes the wonders of Constantinople and tells us about the Vandal conquest of Mauritania. But universal histories demand a universal time frame. So he began his work at the beginning with Genesis and tells us about the flood and the generations of Noah and the story of Moses and the children of Israel wandering in the deserts of Sinai, a history that unfolds under the governing hand of God. Now, Gregory was no innovator. He was following quite closely on the heels of Augustine and Orosius, who in turn had been influenced by the Jewish historian Flavius Josephus, writing in after Vespasian's conquest of Jerusalem in 70 of the Common Era. Now, what Josephus had done is he created a chronological scaffolding that allowed sacred history, the history described in the book of Genesis, to be spliced directly onto secular history. And the splice remains visible in all subsequent histories done in this vein. In the case of Gregory of Tours, you can find it right between chapters 16 and 17 of book 1 of the history of the Franks, as Gregory passes from the Hebrew race to talk about the other kingdoms that existed at the time of David and the destruction of the temple and all the events of sacred history. Now, this is a history, and it's a secular history that leads up to the Romans and then by stages down to the Franks. Now, the tradition of writing Judeo-Christian histories that begin with the word was carried on for centuries. In the late 19th century, the great German historian Leopold von Ranke, in the dying years of his career, set out to write his own universal history, which he called a Weltgeschichte, a world history, and it was left unfinished upon his death in 1886. Writing in the 1880s, he was well aware of the challenge of Darwinism and the nature of geological time. He knew that the archaeologists were digging up the fossils and antiquities of man. But as he wrote in the preface to his first volume, the province of history is limited by the means at her command, and the historian would be overbold who should venture to unveil the mystery of the primeval world, the relation of God, of mankind to God and nature. The solution of such problems must be entrusted to the joint efforts of theology and science. And the opening chapters of his book then go on to narrate the story of Genesis. Now, Ted, there is, in fact, some conditional tenses in here, so it's a little more complicated. But as I read it, essentially, he is taking it as factual, literal truth. Now, that Genesis should still be relevant in 1886 is not that remarkable. In certain circles, the habit of writing histories that begin in Eden has never abated. It is significant only because many historians in the United States and elsewhere consider Ranke to be the father of the modern discipline of history. He may have accepted the existence of something that lay on the other side of the veil, but he chose to consign that history to theology and science. Now, that pair, theology and science, did not exactly make ideal foster parents. Ranke's own history was sandwiched between several important volumes in the early history of the warfare between science and religion. which were being published in the latter decades of the 19th century. And the theologians and scientists, as you know, have been duking it out ever since. Yet historians, in the tradition of Ranke, continue to watch indifferently from the sidelines. And this is because history, for all intents and purposes, tells a story that is chronologically and geographically indistinguishable from Genesis. Though the history has been translated into secular terms, it still begins in Mesopotamia, and it still begins 6,000 years ago. To this extent, history gives no comfort to the disciplines who are still fighting the time wars. Now, to understand how it is that the discipline of history remains in the grip of the geochronology of sacred history, we need to go back to earlier centuries and look at the swirl of ideas shaping the narration of human history as an ascent from the primeval past. Like many of his peers, Gregory of Tours had no sense of progress. In medieval texts, you find some ideas of progress. Robert Nisbet has written about this. There's some influence from Book 5 of Lucretius's De Natura circulating the medieval world. And these were inquisitive intellects who were curious about these kinds of things. But even so, the Lucretian schemes of progress had a greater impact on European anthropology and history after the 16th century. And by the 18th century, the ideas that progress in human history has occurred by stages are flourishing in the works of Ferguson, Smith, Turgot, and other great figures of the Enlightenment. These were relatively mechanical accounts, and as such, they removed the governing hand of God. Yet these authors did not necessarily violate the chronological framework assumed by Gregory of Tours and the other historians who wrote in the Judeo-Christian tradition. As Turgot put it in a 1750 treatise, "Holy writ, having enlightened us about the creation of the universe, the origin of man, and the birth of the first arts, before long puts before us a picture of the human race concentrated again in a single family as the result of the universal flood. The urgent need to procure subsistence for themselves in barren deserts, which provided nothing but wild beasts, obliged them to move apart from one another in all directions and hasten their diffusion through the whole world. Soon the original traditions were forgotten, and the nations, separated as they were by vast distances and still more by the diversity of languages, strangers to one another, were almost all plunged into the same barbarism in which we still see the Americans." Here, Turgot had found a clever way to make scripture compatible with the idea of progress. The trick was to assume that the progress of human society began after the deluge. Jacques Bénin Bossuet, bishop, theologian, and preacher at the court of the Sun King in France, had come to much the same solution the previous century. And a similar kind of catastrophism figures in the New Science written by the Neapolitan historian Giambattista Vico around 1725. In Vico's scheme, the deluge destroyed all evidence for human history, apart from sacred scripture, which Noah managed to carry onto the ark with him. Hence, human history could only be studied as history after the deluge. Sacred writ ran for all the time before the deluge. Anticipating Ranke by a century and a half, Vico therefore declared it the province of theology, not history. This was the fatal compromise. In Gregory's History of the Franks, the sacred history of Judeo-Christian scripture had been stitched directly onto the time of secular history. But the great compromise of the Enlightenment caused the two historical times to become unstitched. For Turgot and others made it possible to imagine a secular world history that began after the deluge or any other similar revolution. And I think referring to Sam's talk, that it's in a historical sense, this is ultimately what makes possible the idea that there are two magisteria. Cut loose from, the other point I wanted to make about this, so there's any geologists out there, is that this was much the same sort of catastrophic argument that Georges Cuvier used when he argued that the relevant geology was the one that pertained after the most recent of the great series of crustal catastrophes that he wrote about in his work. Cut loose from secular time, sacred history eventually floated off on its own. Ranke aside, the textbooks that emerged in the United States in the 1880s, textbooks, part of a new history curricula, typically start, you can go and look at them, typically start with the fully formed pyramids of Egypt. Now, none of this was a problem as long as humanity's deep past remained unknown and concealed. But in the 19th century, geologists, archaeologists, and biologists began pulling aside the veil that had hitherto obscured our knowledge of the speechless past. This is what troubled figures like Leopold von Ranke, whose careers had spanned the time revolution of the 1860s. For how could he hope to keep the time of Judeo-Christian history uncontaminated by the tens of thousands of human fossils and eoliths that had been dug up by the 1880s? The only solution was an epistemological one, to declare that these kinds of sources are not suitable for history. As the French historians, disciples of his, Charlotte Langlois and Charles Seignobos, wrote in an important manual of historical methodology published in the 1890s, the historian works with documents. Documents are the traces which have been left by the thoughts and actions of men of former times. For want of documents, the history of immense periods in the past of humanity is destined to remain forever unknown. For there is no substitute for documents. No documents, no history. In the wake of this epistemological move, scientific history came to be restricted to written documents. Just to summarize, why documents? Well, it eliminates the threat posed by archaeology, a threat not only to the sacred history that people like Ranke still believed in, but also the bewildering threat of how the hell are we going to write a history that embraces all of that time, that timeless cyclical Malthusian order that Greg was talking about yesterday. The other answer to the question of why documents is that it allows historians to explain the pathways of histories in terms of a thinking brain. John Locke's Mind First Model, as Dan Dennett wrote about in an earlier work. God was removed as a working hypothesis from secular history, but by retaining the document, you could retain the fantasy that thinking brains govern the pathways of history in some fashion. So what are we left with? A historical framework that by a chronological and geographical sleight of hand continues to teach the history told by Genesis. And maybe this is why we don't take history all that seriously, and why there's so little history, so little good history being done at this symposium. Over the course of the last couple of days, I've seen innumerable references to historical ideas and models. I think you're all desperate to bring the history back into your thinking. And I wonder whether the trap that we historians got ourselves caught in is what has made it impossible for you to think with history. Let me give just a couple of examples. I'll just start with Patricia Churchland's argument. How did the group expand beyond kin? That's a historical question as well as a neuroscientific question. John Haidt made reference to lattice world as an essential ingredient of the model that he was building, even though he didn't historicize it. Sam Harris made just now a very explicit historical argument when he mentioned this phrase, brought this barbarism to us down through the generations. This is a historical argument of the conservation of religious traits across history. Lots of historians ask that question all the time. There's a lot of good history being done on that. So to paraphrase John Haidt, I think that to do the Enlightenment right, we need to get the history right. Thank you.
Questions? Let me just Pat, because this actually follows up from what Dan's been saying, and also what Sam and Austin were talking about before, this whole notion of the happiness issue, the eudaimonia issue. Could you just speak to that as well?
Thanks, Roger. I'll try. But I couldn't agree more that getting the history right is enormously important. And one of the things, I mean, just as a matter of sort of record of the recent past, I think that's one of the things that has marked our particular philosophy department is to really see that development of the best historians of these subjects as absolutely critical to the discipline. Having said that, I'm now going to do what I fear some of my colleagues will think of as rather bad history. And it's because I don't know, in fact, as much about Aristotle as I would like to. But there are several things about Aristotle that I think are particularly relevant, especially to the way Sam was thinking about the relation between facts and values, and his sharing with me and with others suspicion of this dogma that you can't derive an ought from an is. And it makes me mindful of Aristotle because he did something that shows you can't, where you can derive an ought from an is, and it has to do with health. So there is a period where people think that the domain of what is healthy is the domain of the normative, and that should be the specialty of philosophers and mystics and this and that. And it turns out that as we discover more about what is conducive to health, for example, discovering that although water may look clean, it actually contains microbes, that you're able to derive certain things from science about what ought to be the case vis-a-vis health and well-being from what is the case. And I think Aristotle actually had this conception not just with regard to health and sort of harmony of the body, but with regard to the body politic in general. And I'm going on a little bit here because Roger instructed me to, and I'm sort of embarrassed to be kind of making a little speechlet, but anyway, here I go. So Aristotle knew full well that we were social animals and that our sociability could lead to this wonderful thing which gets translated as happiness, but which is called in the Greek eudaimonia, and my colleague Monty Johnson, I'm sure, will be able to give you a much better account of it. But suffice it to say that happiness, or eudaimonia, as Aristotle called it, was not just sort of a cheap, you know, have a good jolly laugh in the hotel room or have a nice hot tub or what have you. It was a really very expansive idea that embraced the traditional virtues of wisdom, temperance, self-discipline, courage, both moral and physical, and so forth. And that this was an idea, it also sometimes gets translated as flourishing or well-being. And so when Aristotle talks about happiness as the end of our, that is, the goal to which we are reaching, he has in mind this really very large and expansive idea about what it is for human flourishing. And moreover, he had the idea, which I think is profoundly right, that by experience and understanding, we can come to see that certain kinds of institutions serve eudaimonia better than others. Now, I'm making this part up because I like these examples a bit better, but we can see, for example, that trial by ordeal does not work as well as trial by a reasonably wise judge or trial by your peers. We can come to see that having certain rules in place in institutions such as schools, such as markets, such as the law courts, actually works better on the whole to reduce misery, to reduce conflict, and so forth. Now, the other thing that I think is so kind of counterintuitive about Aristotle, but which is really, really profound, is that he, unlike Kant and unlike Mill and unlike almost every moral philosopher of the 20th century, he didn't for a moment think that what you had to do was bust your chops to find the right rule to govern all behavior. He realized very well that there wasn't going to be such a thing because humans differ from one another in what satisfies them, because conditions can change, because there can be such a thing as progress. And so what he thought was that you embody such wisdom as you have in various institutions, and to put words sort of in his mouth, that you can evaluate those institutions and you can bloody well derive an ought about what ought to be the case for an institution from what is the case, such as this makes us all really miserable, so we ought to change the law and do something else. And so I think there's a point here which is a kind of change in the history, if you like, of moral theory, where a number of people have been going back to Aristotle, not just to find out what the old boy thought, interesting in and of itself, though that is, but because they see that it embodies certain ideas that are applicable to our own time in a way that the deontology and the consequentialism that were really the central topics of moral philosophy in the 20th century really are not. And have I said enough now? Yeah, can I stop?
No, well, no, it was it was very well said in a meeting like this, where there's obviously certain areas we were able to get to and some that we didn't. And we didn't really have a long discussion about virtue ethics, which has obviously become much to the fore recently and bears completely on what Sam has been talking about. So actually, thank you. Do you want to have a response to that, Sam, at all? Do you want to add something?
I just wish I had said it that well. That was, you know, it's good to know that Aristotle is vaguely on my side.
But. The Aristotelians tend to be much maligned by the consequentialists and the deontologists who really, you know, kind of rule the roost. We are seeing the emergence of books like Natural Ethical Facts by Bill Casebeer, who incidentally, you will be amused and amazed to know, is a colonel in the U.S. Air Force. Did a degree in philosophy with Paul, as it happens. But other people also who are exploring virtue ethics, both, you know, with regard to just what Aristotle actually said, but how to expand what he said in the light of contemporary science, neuroscience, psychology, and what we've learned as a result of these many experiments in politics that have happened since Aristotle was trotting around the globe.
No.
any points on yes, at the back there, sorry.
I'm Monty Johnson in UCSD philosophy. Monty Johnson, UCSD philosophy, and I'm a great enthusiast of Aristotle, and as much as I'd like to pick up where Pat left off, I wanted to make a comment directly about Dan's presentation. I think it's absolutely right that you have to get the history right to do anything right. And I think one thing that we could use is thinking of the history of atheistic movements and the attempt to propagate atheistic ideas. I thought a very interesting part of your talk was when you mentioned Lucretius and an alternative conception of the entire cosmic history merging with human history. Lucretius was an Epicurean. Epicureanism is a 4th century BC Greek philosophy that embraced three principles, basically: empiricism, materialism, and hedonism, which I think could find a lot of agreement in this room. Their concept of happiness was based on getting pleasure right. They believed that the cosmos consisted of atoms and void, and they thought that the only way to know about the cosmos was through sense perception and empirical methods. They tried to develop cognitive psychological mechanisms to replace the fear of gods and death that motivate religion. So instead of just trying to ruin religion, they tried to develop actual tenets that people could rehearse and come to understand in order to replace these things. But as successful as their burgeoning communities were for a while, and as much art and poetry that they gave rise to that was such a huge influence on the Renaissance and early modern philosophy, and I think it can be shown on modern science, in fact, they were completely crushed and almost totally eliminated by the rise of Christianity and other religious forces. And we should study how this happened, because it's one thing to talk about, you know, we all ought to realize that hedonism, materialism, and empiricism is the right thing. It's another thing to figure out how social movements in history that have tried to propagate this idea have fared.
Thank you, Monty.
Thank you.
Dan, you want to reply to that?
Well, I think that Monty's question demands a huge, a very long reply that actually I'm not qualified to give, because I'm primarily a social historian, and I have to admit with complete candor that I tend to cherry pick the philosophy. So I have to leave it up to others. I think Ted actually could handle many aspects of your question much better than I can. The only point I might get at there goes back to an observation that I think was made on the first day, and I can't remember who made it. But it was to the effect I was chatting with Sam about this very briefly last night, that if you look at religion from a historical point of view, you tend to find that the religion tracks very closely the social and material circumstances, political circumstances of given societies. So I'll just throw out one example, namely that historians have been quite interested in depictions of the crucifixion of Jesus between the 8th, 9th, 10th century on the one hand, the 11th, 12th, and 13th century. Oh, and I know you're all thinking, oh God, I don't want to hear about the crucifixion of Jesus, but I'm afraid medieval historians, we have to work with what we have. But the argument runs that the earlier depictions of Jesus depicted Jesus called a Christus Victor, who stands like this and he stares at you and he says, you guys are scum. Right? After the 11th century, the depictions of Jesus become the suffering Jesus who's absolutely gruesome, and he's got the blood dripping down his face and down his side and everything. And that tracks very closely the development of the Crusades, because the suffering Jesus becomes the figure that creates this, we have to take vengeance for what has happened to our Savior. Right. Now, the point is that is the person, whoever it was mentioned on the first day, you have God is this completely plastic figure that moves from one society from one social formation to another one. And I'm a materialist in maybe an old-fashioned Marxist sense to some degree, not really Marxist, but I think of religion as superstructural, and I think that it accommodates what societies want to do, and it becomes the justification for doing what you want to do for other reasons. And I can think of plenty of counterexamples to that. So this is where the historians are actually having their arguments. I think most medieval historians would disagree with me about that. But to answer your question, Monty, what I would do if I'm looking at what happened over the course of the 4th and 5th century to pagan philosophies, the first thing that I would do is, what is happening to the society? And then I would ask the philosophical question.
You talk about the ark and the uniting of humanity by the flood. I'm led to ask you this question. The Greeks developed the ideas of an ideal society. Aristotle had a wonderful pupil who rejected everything he said. I mean, Aristotle thought the morally perfect society would be the city-state, and Alexander went out and threw it in the garbage. The Jews developed an idea of a god that rules the universe, but he was very selective in who he would allow to interpret him. The Christians seem to have united these two ideas and to have created a notion of humanity for the first time. I mean, I'm an anthropologist. I go into the field. I live with tribes. There's no notion of humanity, of everyone belonging to a species.
That's right.
So monotheism creates humanity for the first time in human history. And the French Revolution is simply, to me, a secular version of this. And all the other isms that followed, fascism, communism, colonialism, utilitarianism, democratic liberalism, are all missionary in the sense that there is one people, one species, and they must be saved. They must be made happy. There must be well-being, whatever. And there is always a residue, the evil residue, that either is recalcitrant or does not want to be saved. So my question is, do you see, for example, some of the debates here about religion and atheism simply within this messianic missionary history, which is part of all the isms running around the world today?
I'm not sure I can answer that, Scott. What I would love to do is sit down and get a more finely grained understanding of the question that you're asking, and maybe if I fumble this badly, you can pick up the microphone again. But let me just give one example of some of the thoughts that I've been thinking. It seems to me that, well, maybe one way to start this is that there's not that many of us here who actually study closely the great agricultural civilizations whose moral systems have come in for such abuse at this conference. You know, I was thinking about this earlier, that for every evil that we can chalk up to religion, I have plenty of colleagues who are going to chalk up the things on the other side, and it all kind of dissolves out into a vast nothingness eventually. In sort of partial response to your question, I was just briefly reminded of some of the debates about the origins of humankind in the wake of Darwin's great book about the descent of man. Because it turns out, and I'm sure there's people in this room who know much more about this than I do, including the gentleman sitting to your left, but that it turns out that Catholic doctrine was firmly on the side of the unity of all of the races of mankind, and opposed to the idea of separate races that permit and tolerate slavery. And I'm just reminded of it. It's I could easily come up with plenty of other things on the other side. But in terms of humanity, there's a lot to be said for at least the first part of your statement, namely that there is an enormous idea of universalism that's built into some of the religions. Yeah.
I think Ted, did you have one quick comment? Then we need to move on. Since you were invoked.
To inject history back in and to deal with I'm not so sure Aristotle's on Sam's side, and he's not a consequentialist, and the main reason people are trying to revive virtue ethics is because they realize one of the deep problems with consequentialism is how you measure something like happiness or good depends on your values. I mean, what good is depends on what you think good is, and these are historical questions. And so I guess Aristotle thought that good, and we get confused when we translate eudaimonia as happiness and think that means what we mean by happiness, which is nice Cabernet and a condo with a view of the ocean and nice vacations, right? That's not what Aristotle thought happiness was. It was about living a flourishing life. And so this is a, I think you still have a problem when you respond to the guy who's chopping off the head and you say, well, you're increasing suffering, you got to stop. He'll say, well, yeah, you're an uneducated Westerner, you don't know anything, so let me explain to you. This may seem like I'm reducing happiness in this case, but I'm increasing the greater happiness of my society. I'm defending my tradition. I'm increasing social cohesion. And I'm not sure we can use the discourse of consequentialism to argue with this guy. We've got to then argue about larger issues of just what a flourishing human life looks like. And that's where we start getting trapped in these kind of claims about values of moral premises, as Scott put it, that I'm not sure are amenable to empirical inquiry. So I take this to be part of your point about having to get more historically nuanced when we talk about these things.
Well, absolutely. And one of the points, we can't quantify happiness. I think one of the points about peasants in the Middle Ages is that the vast majority of them are not getting killed by their lords. And just to respond briefly to one of Patricia's observations about the ordeal has been around in scientific circles ever since Henry Charles Lee wrote about superstition and the ordeal in the late 19th century, and it was sort of the big bugaboos in the wars of science and religion. One of my colleagues, Stephen D. White, wrote this fascinating article which describes a peasant engaged in a lawsuit with a monastery over control of land. And he says, I know I own this land, and I'm willing to take an ordeal to prove that to you. And the monastery says, whoa, no, we don't want to do that. Let's settle in some way. The ordeal is this weapon that we now know. It is not this torture device that is used on people. It's this weapon that's available to strategic actors in medieval societies. So this is one of the ways in which understanding what the historians have come up with, and again, what I was trying to say in my paper is this is partly our fault. But if we could come back together and figure out these kinds of things, at the very least, Sam may not want to change his idea that this is a barbaric world or that any past society is a barbaric world, but I think it'd be a hell of a lot more nuanced.
All right, thank you, Dan Smith. Just one more quick thing before the break. These are practical issues, aren't they? I mean, did you see this story in the New York Times just a few days ago that the United Nations having taken up a resolution calling for the abolition of life in prison without the possibility of parole for children and young teenagers, and the vote was 185-1, and the United States was the lone dissenter. And it continues. To be the case that young adolescents, obviously young adolescents, are sentenced to live out their lives in prison. And the story is a quite heartbreaking story of there's an 81-year-old retired social worker called Mary Knowles, and her granddaughter was 14 when she helped her boyfriend kill her grandfather and aunt. That's Mrs. Knowles' husband and daughter. Stabbing them, shooting them, setting them on fire. And she also tried to kill a 10-year-old sister. Mrs. Knowles, this is the lady we're talking about, who's now 81, was badly injured in the rampage. She was in a coma for 30 days. She had also been shot in the shoulder and stabbed in the chest. But she now thinks that her granddaughter, who's 22, should have the possibility of a second chance. She sort of got some time in jail and so on. And there's a long story which then follows about the prosecutors saying that they didn't think that the person should be released, and that the United States was right in withdrawing, holding off from this resolution, because children at that age did not have a conscience. And that word is used in this piece, that didn't have a conscience. So it seems to me that these sorts of things, where we can talk about virtue ethics and consequentialist positions and so on, but if you, I would pick up a phone to somebody like Jay Gidd, and ask him what the story is about the adolescent brain. I mean, what do we actually know about these things? So I just raise this issue to say that I think if we can, and many of you have already made the point, that if we can find some sort of pragmatic use of this wonderful source of information that we have and meld it together with the neuroscience and all the other things that happened since Enlightenment 1.0 to get to the iteration I'm now choosing to call Enlightenment 2.0,